Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants will be in a listen-only mode throughout today's call. Today's call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now, I would like to turn the call over to Dr. Francis Collins.
Thank you, operator, and good afternoon, everyone. This is a meeting of the Advisory Committee to the Director for National Institutes of Health. Welcome to all of you. We have two major issues that we have convened the ACD to discuss, and we'll come to those in just a moment. I wanted to just take a couple of minutes to tell you about two new working groups of the ACD that have been assembled, just so that the Advisory Committee is aware of their activities, because you will be hearing more about them. One of those is a working group focused on the intramural research program at NIH, the IRP, as we call it. As you're well aware, NIH maintains a robust intramural research program designed to foster the pursuit of projects beyond the scope of what is often reasonably fundable in the extramural community. And this includes the ability to start long-term research projects to change directions quickly when scientific opportunity or public health need arises, to take advantage of the largest research hospital in the world, the Clinical Center. Previous reviews of the IRP have been insightful and useful, but the last one is now 11 years old. And we thought it is time for a working group to evaluate, especially in sort of difficult budget times, the sustainability of current approaches, and to identify areas of opportunity and means to enhance the uniqueness of the IRP. This group is being co-chaired by Cato Lorenzen and Larry Tabak. Thank you, Cato, for your willingness to serve as co-chair. And fellow ACD member Helen Hobbs is also on this group. The group has met twice by phone already. Just this week, three members of the working group participated in a site visit to tour the NIH campus and speak with faculty members and senior leadership. And this group is charged now to report back to the ACD at its December meeting regarding its findings. So I'm sure we will have an interesting discussion at that point. The other working group that I wanted to mention was announced in July, and that was a group charged with identifying the best path forward for the National Children's Study at NIH. And we sent you an email about that. The Children's Study, as many of you know, was requested by Congress through the Children's Health Act of 2000 and is currently envisioned to be a longitudinal observational study that will follow 100,000 children from the womb to age 21, with the goal being to enable an examination of the effects of a broad range of environmental and biological factors on children's health, growth, and development. The NCS has had, I think it's fair to say, a tumultuous history. A new National Academy of Sciences report from two or three months ago raised significant concerns about the design, management, and oversight, and hence we have assembled this ACD working group on the NCS to evaluate whether the NCS is feasible as currently outlined and to propose next steps based on their findings. This group is being co-chaired by ACD member Russ Altman and by Phil Pizzo, both from Stanford. Fellow ACD member Renee Jenkins is also on this group. Thank you, Renee. And thank you, Russ, for your willingness to do the co-chairing. We have added to this additional expertise in statistics, toxicology, environmental health science, pediatrics, and other fields, and a roster has been distributed to you. This group has met twice already, once by phone and once in person on the West Coast. They are busy at work and will be reporting back to the ACD at the December meeting regarding their findings. So, again, we're going to have a busy time in December. I hope your calendars are well marked to come and spend that time helping us with these very important decisions about how best to guide NIH's path forward. So, by way of introduction, wanted to mention those two working groups, but now to the main events. First of all, we're going to have a report from the HeLa Genome Data Access Working Group. Following that, a report from the Human Embryonic Stem Cell Eligibility Review Working Group. And I want to be sure that we give time to both of them, so I'm going to be kind of watching the clock here as we plunge in. But first, let's move to the HeLa Genome Data Access Working Group and its chair, Renee Jenkins. This working group has met eight times since its initiation a year ago. Yeah, wow. And evaluated 30 data access requests. This has been a truly historic means by which these requests are being considered, and as you may know, with input from the LACS family. Renee will describe the working group's finding on four requests. And in addition, when we first set this up and worked with the LACS family on data access, the focus was only on whole genome sequence data. We had promised to revisit that policy and determine whether we should broaden the scope to other data types. So NIH and the HeLa Working Group held a workshop on May 14th with an elite group of bioethicists, bioinformatics experts, legal and scientific experts, and members of the LACS family. You'll remember an overview of that workshop was presented at the June ACD meeting. But Renee is now going to describe the working group's findings from this workshop to you today, and we will need to basically discuss and take votes. So thank you, Renee, especially, but all the working group members. I'm sure the ACD members may have questions related to the topic, so I will ask that they pay close attention, and after the discussion, we'll have a chance for people to make inquiries, and then we'll take a vote. So, Renee, can I turn it over to you?
Absolutely. Good afternoon, everyone. As you can see by your agenda, I have 10 minutes, so I'll probably talk really fast, but I think you have the slides, and I will refer to the slide numbers as I move through the presentation. We're going to try to get through a little bit of the background just to remind you about what the work group actually does in terms of what it presents to you, to make you aware of the four access requests that we have had a discussion about, and then talk about the workshop very briefly, and then we'll have an opportunity to have you vote on the workshop recommendation as well as on the four requests that we've reviewed. Slide three, again, reminds you about what the guidelines are for the researchers in terms of what they can request and what we have also outlined in terms of their criteria. For example, requesters are not to make contact with the LACS family, and they are to disclose any commercial plans and include acknowledgement of publications and presentations. And these are the guidelines. Slide four, what the work group actually does is evaluates the request to make sure they're consistent with the agreement. What we do following that is what we're doing today, which is we give a report to the ACD, and then the ACD makes the recommendation to Dr. Collins. So we are reporting to you today. Just to remind you who's on the roster, most importantly, I think, the LACS family. Veronica Spencer and David LACS have been very involved in the discussion, and it's been really, to me, amazing for lay people to be as engaged as they are, and I think it's that the process works. Kathy Hudson is also part of that group, as is Russ Altman, another ACD member, as Dr. Collins told you earlier. And then we have two other experts in the area of genetics who have joined us. And then Clyde Yancey, as you remember, is a former ACD member who is also part of this group. The criteria for evaluating are on slide six. If the proposal has to involve research on health, medical, or biomedical research objectives. We specifically ask about the issues of intellectual property, although we have no jurisdiction over that. We just want to be notified. And then are there any plans to publish or present the findings? Slide seven, as we progressed initially, there was a request to the applicants to have instructions in non-technical language, and it's been really trying to have them really go to non-technical language. Sometimes it looks like they just basically cut and paste what they already wrote in the application. So we are trying again, being much more explicit about what we want in those as a result of that non-technical research summary, and they are in the special instructions. Slide eight. What we do in our review is we either identify that the application is consistent with the data use agreement, that it's inconsistent with the data use agreement, that it's conditional meaning the issues with the application can be resolved internally, and we can basically say go forward once these are satisfied, or it's pending, meaning we want to hear it again, that we are not able to make a determination at the time we initially review it. So, the requests that are currently before you, first of all, just to remind you, we've had 30 requests altogether. 21 were approved by you. One was disapproved. There are still 4 that are pending, and we're reporting on 4 today. Just for an FYI, 10 of the approved requesters have downloaded the data. So, as you see here are on slide 11 are the 4 projects, and Russ Altman has agreed to briefly tell you about them. Russ, are you there?
I am.
Okay.
Would you like me? I can quickly go over them. I think the summaries are pretty good, and I want to take a minute to thank the staff, including Dina Paltu and everybody else, who really make this committee go very smoothly and often create descriptions that are much better than the investigators about what the investigators plan to do, somewhat not surprisingly, I'm afraid. So we have very quickly, in fact, you know, I'd prefer to ask questions just name of keeping time, but the first one was a study from Berkeley where I think the key point is that they're looking at multiple forms of messenger RNA, and they used the HeLa cell line as the model system, and therefore having access to the genome allows them to tell if the mRNA differences that they're seeing are because of differences in the genome or because of editing or other splicing or other events that have happened to the mRNAs after transcription. So again, we looked at that. We thought that would look good. I'm going to keep. I'll forge ahead if that's okay, Renee.
Please.
Mm-hmm. For the second one from the University of Washington, they're interested in a 3D structure of DNA in the nucleus. They have Hi-C data, which is a type of next generation sequencing combined with other experimental assays that gives them basically linkage information that says this part of the genome is close in 3 dimensions to this other part, and the data that they have is on the HeLa sequence, and so for interpreting that data, it's absolutely critical, and we agreed to have access to the genomic data. The third one from the University of Pittsburgh is very interesting, looking for what the effects of viral infection on genomes are. And so, for example, we know that many cervical cancers, as I'm sure many of you know, are associated with HPV infection, and so they want to look at a metagenomic survey of the genome to look for the presence of DNA that might be from infectious agents. And, of course, HeLa is a great model system for this because of the likely etiology, although not proven, of the cancer in the case of Henrietta Lacks. And finally, and forgive me for going so fast, there's a proposal from Vanderbilt that is interested in what the effects on the peptides that are displayed on the surface of cells before and after virus infection. And so they're infecting HeLa cells with vaccinia, and they're comparing the before and after of the displayed peptides, and they want to have the genome in order to tell what of those peptides are encoded and where in the genome to try to unravel how this viral response might be managed. So I think I'll stop there. Of course, it's not enough to really appreciate the science, but I can tell you that we went through these and we thought they were consistent with the data use terms that Renee reviewed previously.
This is Bob Horvitz. I have a question, and that is on slide 11, there's one aspect of information that's not included, but was included in the other material we were sent, which is namely the name of the investigator. Is there any reason going forward we couldn't include that in a slide like slide 11?
We'd be happy to do that, Bob.
I think that could be helpful in some circumstances.
And just real quickly, the University of California, Berkeley is Stephen Brenner. The University of Washington is William Noble. The University of Pittsburgh is James Pippas, P-I-P-A-S, And the Vanderbilt investigator and University of Texas El Paso investigator is Charles Spencer.
Right. This is Ian, just following up on Bob's point. I have to recuse myself for the FIT application because Jim and I work together.
Okay.
So it is important to have those names.
Okay.
Oh, good point.
Very good. Thank
very
you. Good point. Thank you so much. Russ, thank you very much.
And Chris Wilson, I recuse myself from the University of Washington one because I have a consulting relationship on one of their committees, and I also heard Bill Noble present this about a week ago, so I'm biased.
Thank you. Anybody else have a recusal that you would like to mention before we vote on these?
I would just make the argument that knowledge of the science shouldn't be a reason to not participate, but if there is a conflict, then it's fine.
Yeah. Okay. I totally agree with that, Bob.
Thank you.
Otherwise, we may as well go home.
So now we were going to wait till the end to vote.
Fine.
Okay. All right. So we're going to proceed with the what you need to be aware of for the workshop. And we're on now to slide 13. As you see, the workshop focus was to really evaluate policy as to whether we should apply prospectively to the guidelines to any other HeLa genome data types. And it was a one-day meeting. You can see here are the workshop participants. And you may also note that the LAX family, I think, had four members that were at the workshop, and they were very engaged in the discussion.
Mm-hmm.
There were not only scientists who were working with HeLa cells, but also ethicists.
Mm-hmm.
They gave really important presentations. So I think it was a very worthwhile and informative meeting. I don't know, Kathy, you want to say anything else about it?
Mm-mm. Go ahead.
Okay, great. Okay. So the agenda overview, again, was looking at future considerations around open access, issues around the scientific value of the HeLa genomic data, what privacy risk exists, what ethical implications there are of open versus controlled data access, and also applying the HeLa genomic data policy to other genomic data types. And the LAX family expressed themselves specifically and felt as though their desire was to have scientists have access to the HeLa genomic data. They did not want to add any policy issues that would delay or halt the progress of the science with the HeLa cells, but they did want to be informed about the scientific developments associated with scientists who use the HeLa cells. So the outcomes of the workshop are on slide 17, and there was not much enthusiasm, which is a nice way of saying it, for expanding the policy. There was a very active discussion about that. There was also expressed that the HeLa genomic data beyond whole genome sequences do not need to be kept in controlled access. There was a discussion about the HeLa cell research collection, and I think we are not going forward with that because of the amount of effort and time that would be necessary to do that. And then the research symposia, which there was some enthusiasm for, and so I will put that together in a recommendation that the work group had. And information sharing with the LAX family, which I think is occurring and would actually, if we accept a research symposia going forward, would be an additional opportunity for them to be aware of that. So on slide 18, you see that the privacy considerations are not significant enough to outweigh the scientific and public health benefits of adding other genomic data types to limited access. And the work group also endorsed a periodic symposium in association with the current national scientific meeting, as opposed to having a specific meeting that is generated by NIH. Okay. So the next steps are to make a recommendation to Dr. Collins from the ACD. And then the NIH would consult with the Lax family going forward before Dr. Collins would make a final decision. Okay. And so I think that's the end of the presentation. Am I on time?
You're doing great, Let's hear if there's discussion from the ACD members. Again, remember how this works. Working groups present you with findings. You then have the chance to discuss, and then we'll have a vote for you to make recommendations. Okay. Then I receive those, consider them, in this case, discuss them with the Lax family, and make an ultimate decision. But are there discussion points?
What we've put up, as you look at slide 21, it once again has the list of the data access requests.
Just a comment. I'm so impressed that the family is interested in the science, mm-hmm. and I think that, you know, every opportunity should be taken to commend them on that.
Totally agree with you, Peter, and I believe Jerry Lax is listening in to this call, and Jerry has been remarkably dedicated to this effort, and we will continue to benefit from the input from her and other Lax family members. So maybe, Renee, we'll need to take two votes after people have a chance to discuss, perhaps one on the data access request and once on the workshop findings. But maybe we could start with the data access request.
Okay, do we need a motion from...
This is Ian. I move to accept.
Great. Do we have a second?
Second.
Yes.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
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 All of you. Any opposed?
And we noted the people who were recused on the basis of institutional conflicts. Were there any abstentions?
Thank you.
Not counting the recusals we already heard about? Okay.
All right. So
now to the workshop.
Yes. The second vote would be to endorse or to approve the recommendations that are on slide 18.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Now 22, I think, is sort of the way it's been put forward. For
Tina has it all organized, and I'm just not paying attention. Okay. All right, so no change to the heliogenome data policy, but to recommend that the NIH should hold a periodic special session at a national scientific meeting focusing on the research utilizing HeLa cells. Do I hear a motion?
So moved.
Do I hear a second?
Second.
Any discussion? Hearing none, and no one abstained? All right, then we are done. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Okay, and none opposed. Okay.
All right.
Kind of biased way of asking.
Robert,
you should see their faces. I mean, really. Okay. All right. Okay.
All right. Thank you, Renee.
Amazing.
You're welcome.
Very speedy.
Friday.
That's fantastic.
All right.
And I will consider your recommendations, and I'll consult with my staff, and in the case of the workshop, the Lax family, before I make any final decisions. Jerry, thank you for being listening in. And much praise for Renee, who has ably led this effort over this year with those 8 meetings and a really unprecedented series of discussions that I think have really brought great credit to the working group in terms of how you've conducted business. So
but
many,
I think
many
Russ,
thanks.
Russ really underscored the fact that internally it's just a great group. And so they really prepare you for everything. So thank you for giving me the opportunity.
And since Renee is scheduled to rotate off of the ACD at the end of December, we thought we ought to think about succession planning. And so I'm happy to say that an ACD alumnus, who's also listening in, Dr. Clyde Yancey, has agreed to co-chair the working group with Dr. Hudson when Renee rotates off at the end of December. So, Clyde, thank you for your many, many contributions to NIH. You're about to add another one.
Mm-hmm.
That's much appreciated. And we will have another ACD member also join the group after we have a chance to be sure that it is going to work out for that individual. So, without any further ado, I think with remarkable good timing here, it being almost exactly 3:30, we should move on to the next topic, which is the report from the Human Embryonic Stem Cell Eligibility Review working group. Jeff Botkin, are you on the phone?
I'm here.
And let me say how grateful I and others are to you for your role in chairing this group over the years, and really appreciate your joining us now to present a couple of issues that you want the ACD to consider. So I'll turn it over to you. I think Ann Lyerly, who's a member of the working group, is also on the phone, and Jeff Murray, a former working group member and ACD alumnus, I believe is also on the phone, at least I hope so. No?
I'm here.
And Ella is here. And Story Landis also is in the room with us, and Ellen Gadbois. So we have lots of people who've spent a lot of time working on these complicated issues. But, Jeff, let me turn it over to you.
Great. Thanks, Dr. Collins. And my thanks to Story Landis and Ellen Gadbois for the great support they provided us for this meeting and really consistently over the years. So my thanks. So I'm on the second slide now. And a brief overview of what we're going to do with this part of our presentation. We're going to talk just briefly about the guidelines that we're working under, present then a single line that we've had the opportunity to talk about on several occasions in the past, present to you our working group analysis for your consideration, and then open it up for your further discussion and vote. I'm looking now at the third slide, and this is a list of our working group members, so my thanks to this group, which has really proven to be a wonderful collaboration with some just terrific people.
And I should have said thanks to Cato at the beginning, who's also part of this group. Much appreciated.
Yeah, and Cato's been involved with this particular case discussion, so he'll be a help if questions come up about how we were thinking about this issue.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Mentioned Dr. Annie Lyerly's on the line, too. She's the primary reviewer for this a particular application, so if we really get into the weeds, hopefully Annie can help us out with that. So next slide, number four. This is a brief summary of where we've come from and what the standards are here. In effect, since 2009, so stem cells must be derived from embryos created by IVF for reproductive purposes and no longer needed, and donated by individuals who have given their informed consent. So the key thing here is that embryos cannot be created for research purposes. They must be left over from couples who no longer need them for their reproductive planning. The working group uses so-called Section 2B criteria. So all applications that came in after the implementation of the new guidelines in 7709 have to fulfill 2A criteria, and those are reviewed internally at the NIH. We review 2B criteria, which are lines created before that period of time to assess the ethical conduct of investigators in obtaining those lines. So I'm looking at slide 5 now. Here are the 2B guidelines. So the ACD working group will take into account principles of Section 2A. Those are the criteria that must be met for the newer lines since 2009. We take into consideration the requirements in the common rule. And then there are several points to consider, whether the couple was informed of other available options pertaining to the use of the embryos, whether they were offered any inducements for the donation, and whether they were informed about what would happen to the embryos. So the application today is being considered under these 2B criteria. So slide number 6. This particular application is a resubmission, now from NeoStem, but it was formerly called California Stem Cell Incorporated, so you'll see the designation CSCI on these slides. This was from a embryo that was frozen and derived in 2006 from a couple in California. So this is the third ACD discussion of this particular line. A lot of information on the next slide here, number 7, so I'm going to walk through this fairly quickly, and we can come back to the details if folks have additional questions. So we first looked at this application in June of 2012, or the ACD did, and there were concerns about several aspects of the application. The original consent form that was signed by the couple lacked any information about their ability to withdraw prior to the time in which a stem cell line was derived or prior to a time at which the materials were de-identified. And that is one of the 2A criteria. It was also what we considered to be exculpatory language in the consent form, and it indicated that once the couple had signed that form that they would lose control over what would happen to the embryo. That's inconsistent with federal regulations, and it's sort of augmented potential confusion around their ability to withdraw the embryo until the time that a stem cell line had been derived. We also could not verify that a procedural document that included information about the couple's ability to withdraw was in effect at the time of the donation. So we had made a recommendation to the ACD, or our finding to the ACD was for not disapproval, and the ACD accepted that recommendation, and the NIH disapproved the line. Then in December of 2012, the applicant submitted attestation from an embryologist that indeed the procedural document was in effect. Nevertheless, our working group remained uncertain that the rights of the donors had been adequately protected, and we did not come forward. We did not change our recommendation at that point. So now slide 8, please. So today what we're talking about are two new consents from the same couple. The couple was asked to sign a second consent that we'll talk about in a little bit of detail here in a minute, in July of 2013. And here's the heading. This middle bullet is the heading that's on top of that consent form. Consent to affirm your willingness to allow the use of CSCI for embryonic stem cell line derived from one of your embryos, NIH-funded research, and to affirm your willingness to allow the line on the NIH registry. They recognized that this new consent didn't really fix the problems of the original consent. Nevertheless, the hope was that it would express the couple's willingness to have the line listed on the NIH registry and then used subsequently in NIH-funded research, which is really the decision going forward at that period of time. Several concerns about that second consent from our working group, and the first bullet here includes fairly lengthy language that was included in the background information of that consent document. I won't read that whole thing, but I'll just highlight a couple of the elements where it says that millions of dollars have been employed in this research, showing huge promise for addressing the unmet medical needs of tens of thousands of Americans. And as I'll mention in a minute, I think our concern was that was perhaps over-promising or excessively optimistic in terms of the near-term benefits of the decision they were making. There was a comment about the only risk being the loss of confidentiality, but also particularly problematic for this second consent is the third bullet, where it says your participation in allowing the line to be included in the NIH registry is voluntary. You may decide not to participate, or you may leave the study at any time. So next slide, please. So our analysis of this second consent, first of all, posed a problem for us because we had not really established any formal guidelines for dealing with second consents, that is, consents that had been obtained after the embryo had already been destroyed and the line had been created. So we had to grapple with somewhat new territory for us. A particular concern highlighted in the second bullet is that language about their ability to withdraw. Now, I think our suspicion, or at least my suspicion, was that's probably boilerplate language that existed in some informed consent template that they simply left in. But from our perspective, it didn't seem to make any sense. What did it mean to offer the couple the opportunity to withdraw their line from the research? Did that mean remove it from the registry? Did that mean if they had changed their minds that somehow the NIH would or others would try to pursue anybody who was conducting research with downstream cells? Did not seem like it was in fact a feasible or reasonable option to offer this couple. The next slide, please. So here's really our analysis. We felt with the second that the claims of scientific progress and impact really put a fair amount of pressure on the donors to agree to this new opportunity or to sign the new consent form. On the other hand, the couple had signed two consent forms at this point saying that they were willing to have their line derived from their embryo to be used in stem cell research. So we didn't want to deny them the opportunity to contribute to science if, in fact, that's what they were committed to. Nevertheless, we voted unanimously to present a negative finding to the ACD, again on that line, and that did not actually come up for ACD vote since it didn't change the status of the line at that time. So the story then proceeded on to slide 12 here, which is a third consent document. So this is the third one signed by this same couple, submitted to the NIH in June of this year. I won't read the whole heading there, but it's highlighted in the center where they include in the heading greater clarity about their ability to withdraw and basically telling them they don't have that ability. So with that clause, it says, with the understanding the cell line cannot be withdrawn once it's distributed to NIH-funded laboratories. And that's highlighted in the text here in the third bullet. It will no longer be possible to withdraw consent for use of these cells for research for the treatment of others. In addition, the language that we had concerns about that had seemed to be over-promising scientific progress was eliminated from this third form. So our discussion then at the working group level was long and fascinating. Some members were willing to accept the third consent, so we now have three different documents that this couple has signed indicating their interest in contributing to stem cell science, and that although the consent process was significantly flawed in a number of ways, a number of the members did not want to deny the opportunity for this couple to contribute to the scientific enterprise. On the other hand, some members were concerned that the second and third consents really did not remedy the shortcomings of the first consent. Most of what we deal with the committee is people's decision to contribute their embryos for stem cell derivation. And the feeling for those working group members was that that process was flawed and folks were not making a fully informed decision at that point, then the second and third consents didn't fix those fundamental problems. So our final vote then, unusual for our working group to be split, but we were split. We had ultimately four of our members who were in favor of suggesting that the ACD recommend approval of the line, and three who continued to hold the position that it was not appropriate to approve this line and were recommending a negative vote in that regard. So let me go ahead and stop there and see if there are any questions for me or any questions that Dr. Lyerly or that Dr. Lawrenson might help with.
This is Russ Altman. I have a question. Thank you for a very cogent summary of the history, which is quite remarkable. And it's one of two situations. It's either donors who really, really want to make this contribution, and you could imagine very deep-seated reasons why they would want this to happen, and you could imagine a frustrated couple who just keeps trying with their colleagues at the company to do something that makes it perfectly clear that they really want this used, or you could have people at the company who are extremely motivated to have this cell line approved and who have relatively compliant couple who are willing to do this because they really perhaps don't care as much but have some personal connection with the company. And I'm wondering if you have any data on which of those situations. Are we dealing with a couple that is just desperately trying to get their former embryo to be used?
Yeah, this is Jeff. I would say that nicely articulates the our challenge here. And we, of course, haven't had any direct interaction with the couple. And so all of the knowledge we have about that couple has come through the company and through these consent forms. So I don't think we have a good answer to an excellent question. I don't know, Annie, do you think, is that a fair statement?
I would agree with that. I would also say I think that the length of this process suggests that there is a very motivated research group or scientist at the other end of the spectrum. Although I don't know that to be true, I think there is a suggestion given given how long this process has been and all of the different ways in which approval has been all the different ways in which they have sought approval, you know.
Jeff, Ellen Gadbois has information here that might be relevant about the relationship between the company and the couple. Ellen, can you?
Sure. Our understanding is that the company does not have a direct relationship with the embryo donors. They don't know their identity. So the second and third consents were done through the IVF clinic, who has the link between the stem cell line and the embryo donors.
I'm not sure that the question is really all that relevant,
mm-hmm.
In part because it's so difficult to answer, but, I mean, independent of that, we want a policy that is going to be sensible and consistent, and in either of the two cases that were painted, the answer might well want to be this. We might want it to be the same answer in either case, because the objective facts that are most relevant, which is, do the parties involved understand and agree? Whether they're agreeing because they're driven, or whether they're agreeing because they don't care enough to disagree with someone who wants something else, I'm not sure is all that central. But since what's been said, I think makes this particular case maybe easier because we can diffuse it a bit. We may not have to deal with that. But I just don't see that it's necessarily a key issue.
I'd like to follow Bob's point. This is Ian. My major concern is to ensure that we truly have informed consent without any undue pressure. And as long as that pertains, I would be on the side of the for vote. My concern is slightly different and larger, and that is there's a lot of language here about the fact that one can do all sorts of things with these lines without informed consent as long as it's not federal-funded research. So my concern is that something doesn't somehow get washed and advanced, and then we have to play this catch-up game at the end. So even if we approve this, and this, there should be very clear effort try to ensure that something like this doesn't get to the stage again.
One question in that context, is there an opportunity for us, i.e. NIH, working group, et cetera, to interact earlier in the process to help guide what an informed consent should be?
So could I just, this is Story Landerson, I was involved in the generation of the stem cell guidelines in 2009, and the problem that we ran into was that once those guidelines were put in place, every submission we have had since then where the donation was made after absolutely meet those guidelines. So we have completely cleaned up this process.
Great.
This embryo was donated in 2006, 3 years before those guidelines were in place. And so we have tried, when we put these guidelines together, we tried by the creation of these 2B criteria to recognize that the policies before the guidelines were put in place may not have dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's. So we do not see consents like this anymore. And I would tell you that we have not had new cases that have come before the ACD working group from embryos donated significantly before the guidelines were put in.
The story,
right? Story. All of that is clear. I guess to focus my question, there was a second resubmission that didn't have satisfactory language that was in 2012. And so my question is, if something like this does happen at that point, is there a way to interface?
Well, and Bob, this is Kathy Hudson. It's a great question. And in fact, after the second submission, there was an interaction. And Story and Ellen and I had a conversation with the company in order to make clear what the issues were. And so the response in the third consent really is in part from that interaction.
Okay, so there was after the second, but not after the first. But presumably going forward, others would be helped in a similar way.
Yes, if there were others who had lines that where the embryos had been donated before. But I would tell you, I think we're very close to this ACD working group being out of business for lines
right.
that for embryos that were donated in the U.S. They
right.
also will deal with embryos donated overseas, and to be honest, we have not had cases recently that fit under that umbrella.
We did have the Chinese line.
Yeah, but
right.
that
right.
Yep. was a year plus ago.
Yeah.
Well, with respect to China, there's a very large stem cell program.
Yes, but
so
they don't care. They don't seem to care about whether or not the lines are registered on the NIH registry. We do
I
not
see.
Get
applications.
We don't get applications for listing on our registry.
But that, if let's say an investigator wants to use a line that's not on the NIH registry, don't we need some sort of informed consent to make sure that that's an appropriate use?
They can't.
Of the line?
They can't
they
do
can't
the
do
research
that.
With NIH funds.
Okay, that's
period.
My question.
Yeah.
That's the Obama executive order.
Great.
Other discussion?
Well, I guess I want to add, just sort of to emphasize the points that, this is Annie, that were made in the summary. There was a section of the working group that was concerned that reconsenting the donors wouldn't redress meaningfully the failures of the initial informed consent, because at the point that somebody is donating their embryos for stem cell derivation, they have other options available to them. The point at which these individuals were being informed of the possibility of being on the stem cell registry, they had already donated their embryos. Those other options were not available to them, so they were morally and experientially in a different place. And so I think the big question for our group was whether it was appropriate to consider reconsent as a reasonable process. And so I maybe that's understood, but I think that that's this, one of the central differences on the committee was whether or not that this could serve as something that could reassure us that this was respectful of the donors.
Yeah, hi, this is Cato Lorenzen. The other issue, and I think that there were variable levels of concern about this, was the concept of a slippery slope of being able to, if one is able to reconsent, whether other companies might come out of the woodwork with their with donors that had not been properly consented, and bring to try to have them reconsented. And obviously we know now that the instructions are there and people have been given the instructions in terms of what should be in the consent form. But are there companies that didn't even try to propose something to the NIH because of the fact that they knew that they didn't properly consent the person, you know, the donors in the beginning, and didn't even take a moment to think about coming to the NIH, but now would maybe go back and search out those individuals to reconsent them? I believe that some felt that that was not an issue and shouldn't be an issue, and others felt that, on the committee, felt that that was an issue and that was a slippery slope issue that was there. And I think that was one of the other reasons why there was a split in terms of the group, with a thin majority now voting on this case to move forward.
This is Rick Lifton. I appreciate all of these considerations, and the part that I'm struggling with is this point about how deficient was the first consent, and are we viewing this critically from a perspective in 2014 that is very different than we would have looked at this in 2006, or that the company looked at it with in 2006. So where I'm struggling is trying to decide how compromised the first consent was to try to understand how significant the repairs that have been made subsequently are.
Yeah, this is Jeff, and I guess I would say this is an application that the working group felt on several occasions had a couple of pretty significant problems with it. And it wasn't that there was one thing that was sort of clearly a deal killer, but there were absence of the withdrawal language and their original feedback to the committee that they had no documentation about withdrawal, and then subsequently coming forward with more information later once we had disapproved the line, in addition to a number of other errors, didn't give us strong confidence that this was a group that had all of their ducks in a row, if you will, at the beginning, and that we felt that there were enough problems with it that the group was unanimous in its original recommendation for a negative finding. So,
right. So I get that, but the question is, for a consent form in 2006, before the guidelines were drawn, saying that it didn't meet the current guidelines, I think is perfectly reasonable. And the question is, how egregious were the errors in general consent that we would say that they can't be, they would be ineligible to be remedied?
So this is Kathy Hudson. I want to make a couple of points just based on the experience and maybe story, and Ellen can chime in, of the kinds of consents that have been reviewed. And these are consents, again, that were obtained in advance of the guidelines being put in place. So there were no guidelines, and people were presumably doing their best. And the language about you may withdraw at any time really is boilerplate language and was probably included in error. I don't know how much that ends up influencing research participants or prospective participants in terms of their agreement to participate, but there have been consents with language about you can withdraw at any time or you may just withdraw, or very similar language that have been approved by the working group and approved by the ACD and the NIH director. So there is an issue of fair, maybe not fairness, but at least consistency of our behavior that I think we need to be mindful of. And the other is that there are consents where the consent is for use in research, full stop. So there's nothing more specific that is being provided to these donors than research. In this case, the donors are very well informed about exactly what the use is that's going to be made of their stem cell lines, and I think that that should be taken into account as well. And while the company may have not gotten this right the first time or even the second time, I think that the couple has been very consistent in expressing their desires, and it gives me pause to sort of second guess what they have indicated as their wishes.
So, hi, this is Huda. Can I ask a quick question about how much feedback is the couple getting? For example, if we say the stem cells cannot be used going forward, does that have to get back to them?
Yeah. So the registry is public. They could go and check, and in fact, they could even be listening to this discussion because this was put in the Federal Register, and
they know the name of the line because it's in the consent.
And they know the name of the line.
Yeah.
So, okay. So it does. We do need to consider. This is not going into some pool, and sometimes people know, and sometimes people don't know what happens to their you know, contributions and samples, but this is a particular case where, you know, it is very important to be mindful of what we think their intent and their degree of determination was about having these lines being used.
That's right.
Is that a fair conclusion?
Yes.
Okay.
Is the committee convinced that that this couple does want to donate these lines?
We never know with consents, right? So they've signed the consent, and we don't try to do that in research consents usually to then unless we're doing research on consent.
Well, but if we assume that that's what they really want to do,
mm-hmm.
it's not as though this is a renewable resource and people can go back and say, well, we didn't get the consent properly this time, but you can donate embryos again. I mean, this is a one-shot opportunity. So if we truly believe this is what they want to do and we think the consent is appropriate, I would be in favor of supporting the four.
So I'm mindful of the time because I know we only asked you all to hang on for an hour. And Jeff, you're moderating here. I don't know if you're ready to suggest calling the question.
I don't have any additional information to provide, and so I guess I would say unless ACD members have other key comments that they want to contribute, then perhaps it's time.
So you want to call for a motion?
Yes.
Someone care to make a motion?
Ian, I move to approve.
Second.
More discussion?
Do we have to go down?
Oh, okay. I guess we can try for a voice vote. If it turns out that there's significant split, we'll do a roll call. But first of all in favor of the motion, please say aye.
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 All opposed?
Aye.
Well, that would be a nay, but
nay.
Friday. Okay, I heard one nay. Any abstentions? Okay, Jeff, I think that very much gives a outcome for your very thoughtful discussion. Thank you, everybody. This is a really complicated issue, and no doubt the complications are clear by the fact that our working group, who has labored long and hard on this, remained in a circumstance of not being entirely clear what the right answer is. Again, I'm taking this under advisement. That's how we do this. I will contemplate the thoughtful discussion we've had and make a decision. But I really appreciate the time that has been put into this by all of you. And again, especially thank you to you, Jeff.
Thank you.
And the members of the working group who have gone through this several times.
Wow.
I think it's actually, somebody could write a dissertation about this one, and maybe they will. Okay, I think we are at closure other than my needing to remind the ACD members to sign and date the conflict of interest form that was provided on your share file site and either email it to Gretchen or fax it to the number that's provided. And otherwise, we would like to wish you a good weekend and look forward to seeing all of you in person in December, where, as I said at the beginning, we're going to have a very busy meeting. So please plan to be here for the entire thing and be ready to focus on some very important issues. So many thanks, everyone. We are now adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very good.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Take care.